Good evening. It is Intuitive Soul Radio with your host, Lori Houston. And tonight we are blessed. Once again, I have a great lineup this evening. I have Justine Toms, the author of Small Pleasures, Finding Grace in a Chaotic World. Justine is the co-founder and managing producer of New Dimensions Media, a world broadcasting network, and a worldwide media communications group that seeks to explore the changing landscapes of possibilities in the world today. This book has sort of helped us see the kind of person you are with its rich stories and through the types of stories you told and chose. It's full of love and guidance. You guide us to be more aware of who we are through the kind of person you are. And you're an activist who lives your life fully. And if you become passionate about something, you delve into it or you do a show on it. And so your life comes to a deeper place, which we get to share by reading the book. You know, sometimes when you read a book, it's really clear about, you know, how you're going to do the interview and what that's going to look like. And your book is kind of a weaving tapestry of, you know, visual imaging and stories that are part of your life. And it just was really lovely to read, and it kind of refreshing from the, you know, deeper spiritual type books. And yet it's full of the same type of wisdom, just told in a different way. So welcome, Justine.
Thank you so much, Lori. It's so good to be with you this evening.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, your book talks a lot about your journey and the different places you've been, but why don't you tell us a little bit of how you kind of got to here? Like, you know, you're doing a lot of different things, and, you know, I'm wanting almost to get to the same place you're at now, which, you know, it's going to take a few years considering you've been doing it for 30. But, you know, like, what sort of brought you here? How did it, you know, how did it begin? What was the juicy part of you getting to where you are now?
Well, the juicy part, 35 years ago, in 1973, when I first met my husband, Michael, we sat down and we had this very deep conversation about, well, at that time it was really focused on spiritual things because I really wanted to get to know him better, but I really wanted him to come over to my spiritual way of looking at things, mm-hmm. which was it was actually quite narrow, although I thought it was quite broad. And that conversation that night, and this is I'm pretty sure that the book opens with this story. Mm-hmm. That conversation that night, he just kept opening the conversation, making it broader, making it wider. He never said, no, you're wrong, Justine. It's not like that at all. It's like this. He never said that. He said, well, I hear what you're saying, and you might look at it like this. And then every time he said that, he would just come out with this wonderful, much more broader context that included what I was talking about, but actually in a bigger pasture. It lived in a bigger pasture, and I got so excited about that and you know, I stayed, and we've been together ever since. But the point is that conversation was really the birthing of the work that Michael and I have been doing for now more than 35 years.
Wow.
And that's having conversations with some of the world's most visionary wisdom leaders. And we continue to ask these questions and continue to talk and grapple with, okay, who are we? Why are we here? What are the possibilities? What are some of the solutions rather than only focusing on the problems? Except now they're microphones, and so everybody gets in on the conversation. And we've been doing this now, as I say, for 35 years, and it's now heard all over the world. Mm-hmm. It's heard on about 300 communities around the U.S. and all over Australia and a few places in Canada and New Zealand. And, of course, it's on the Internet. And so for 35 years, I've been talking to these people and being excited by all sorts of ideas and learning new questions to ask, and it just kind of is, it's my tendency. I just get excited about ideas, and people ask me often, well, who's the one person that stands out in 35 years? And I must say, it's usually the last person I talk to. Because I just think that they're all wonderful. Some of them are very, very famous, like the Dalai Lama, or we've had hours and hours with Joseph Campbell or Arbuckminster Fuller and people like that. And then we've had a lot of wonderful programs with people you probably wouldn't recognize their names, but nonetheless, just as interesting, as stimulating, as inspiring. So that's the way I started, and how I've progressed through this 35 years. And this book, Small Pleasures, Finding Grace in a Chaotic World, it came out of when people would ask me, well, what have you learned? And I thought, well, yeah, just what have I learned? What are those gems, what I call those insights that consistently hold me steady in these chaotic times, or those stepping stones, as I call them, as I cross the chaotic stream of my life? I don't know about you, Lori, but I mean, sometimes it does feel like a real chaotic stream as we move forward in our lives. Wouldn't you say?
Oh, definitely. I mean, these times that we're in, especially with this, you know, this apparent, you know, financial crisis that, you know, seems to be more than North American, seems to be quite global. And the energy that it, you know, radiates and intensifies in the planet, you know, it's hard to detach. I mean, sometimes, you know, you're finding yourself in a state of fear where you don't need to be, and it's like, oh, wait a minute, this isn't mine. You know, I mean, it's always being ever present, ever aware, and, you know, the chaotic. I mean, it can be crazy sometimes, and, you know, I get this beautiful gift of being able to talk to these people that, you know, are very grounded and very, you know, very into their own awareness and spirituality, and it reminds me of those times when, you know, when you do take that grace of a moment, or the, you know, the pleasure of meditating, or the, you know, those times when we do take it for ourselves, and we get back into that connection, and we feel that beauty and the pleasures, and we forget just how incredible that is. And so it's amazing when I get to do these interviews, because I get to remind myself forcefully, you know, that those moments are here, and they're plentiful, and they're, you know, they're so rich with emotion and beauty. And yeah, it truly is, you know, the small pleasures in life that we need to be reminded of.
Well, I do think that we need reminders all the time. We stray off really easily, because we are living in a time of Olympic levels of distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And it wants to pull us off and pull us into fear or into a worry, rather than staying in curiosity and optimism. So we need these reminders. We need to help each other constantly. And sometimes I often talk about how it's, what can we do to help ourselves know that we're even in fear? Because sometimes we've spiraled down, and we're way down there before we realize we've even been spiraling, and to kind of pull ourselves up for a moment, or I'm just so grateful when I realize, oh, I've been worrying for the last 10 minutes. Now, what is that about? Well, actually, Lori, the good news is we don't worry for 10 minutes at a time, because monkey mind won't allow us to. Monkey mind won't allow us to have any one thought for any length of time, but it might just feel like it's 10 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever at a time. But actually, our mind is shifting from thought to thought to thought constantly. Mm-hmm. But But we might keep repeating, going back to some sort of fearful place, and that's what this book is really about, is to give some little anecdotes and some little helpmates to help us to clear that away, but in very practical terms, in very everyday stories that we all encounter.
Yeah, and you're just it's refreshing also because you're so honest. I mean, you go to a point where you were talking about, you know, how we're supposed to balance our positive thoughts with our negative thoughts, and how are we supposed to do that because we spend 23 hours and 50 minutes in the negative.
Right. And I've been assured, and I choose to believe that the good thoughts, actually, we don't have to balance the bad thoughts and the good thoughts, or the contractive, I won't call them bad thoughts, they're not, but those thoughts that cause us to contract as opposed to those that cause us to be expansive and feel more peaceful, they actually don't have to balance out, and that's good news because I think we'd be in real trouble. But the good ones, when we do have those moments of meditation or introspection, or we're just with our animal companions, we're just playing with our dog. I just visited my son in New Orleans and his wife in. And I met their new little dog and cat. And honestly, it was so beautiful to watch this dog and cat play. They just went at it. And they have, when they finally have had enough of each other, they have this little structure. And it has a little round cylinder at the bottom covered with a rug, and the dog crawls into that, and then on the top it has a kind of hammock up above, and the cat crawls up on that. But you know, I notice when I'm with them, I'm not thinking about the future, or I'm not regretting the past. I'm just there in total delight. And that's where our animal companions can really help us. Even, I mean, there's formal meditation, and that's great, but there are also these other breaks that we can have, or go out in the yard and just listen to the birds. It just takes us out of our everyday worries and fears.
Yeah, I have a few people that I talk to that I bring on the show that are animal communicators. And, you know, we always say, you know, it's the animals have complete unconditional love. I mean, they show us, they're our teachers in helping us remember what that is, because they're so loving. They have, you know, they have no agenda. They just enjoy our presence. And I have a beautiful white kitten that is, and now he's a cat because it's been a year, but he's a joyful bundle of energy, that's for sure.
Oh, aren't they wonderful? Now, cats, you know, what they do is they remind us to take care of ourselves. Mm. They do their yoga every day.
Sometimes on top of us.
They take frequent naps, you know. They sit in the sun and listen to the birds. Now, I think they listen to the birds for a different reason than we do. And the dogs, as you say, they're unconditional love, non-judgmental. They are total joy and exuberance. And so they teach us all about that kind of unconditional love. They're just marvelous, just dogs and cats are great. And then all the other animals that are around us, that we're surrounded by. Mm-hmm. What a blessing, the diversity on this planet. Mm-hmm. Just such a blessing.
And you certainly have a connection with horses, and that's a special place within
yes,
you.
Yes. Horses are... They're so intuitive. Horses are mind readers. They read our minds. They really do, and they're such a just very, for me at least, a special animal. I think of horses as a real totem for me, a real power animal for me, and I have some stories about my first act of power when I was a little girl. Was that act of getting my own horse, and it was an amazing story, and I remembered that when I really need to remember, what does it feel like to attract something to you that you really desire, that you set up an intention and you really say, I want this in my life. And I remember that feeling I had that I was going to get that horse no matter what. It was as good as done. It was like Captain Picard of the Starship Enterprise saying, make it so. It was for me. There was no other reality other than that. And in the story itself, when I got up that Christmas morning and my horse was not under the tree, and I was so disappointed, it was like I entered a reality that was so foreign to me, because I just couldn't understand, because my reality was that horse would be there. And I went through a moment of disorientation. And then over breakfast, my grandfather, I was down in Alabama at my grandparents' house, and all of us were visiting. We were having Christmas down there. And my grandfather turned around and said, well, Justine, what are you going to do with your new horse? And it was just like, so going from the depths to the heights all in like 2 seconds. And I just ran out. And it took that long to get the horse from the farm all the way up to the house in town. And it was just so wonderful. So I remember that act of power and what it took to have your mind, your body, your spirit, your emotions, all of them so lined up that nothing else was possible except for this to absolutely occur in your life.
Mm-hmm. So a very powerful example. And you also talk about, you know, the triumph, that when you can experience the triumph of, you know, getting your horse to jump or getting your horse to do something, and that knowledge and being able to then carry that over when you, in later in life, when you know, you need to remember that you can triumph.
Right. You remember, especially when we're doing things in sports, especially something that we've done, we've actually done it in the body, that and it lives not just as an intellectual concept, oh, I've done this and been there, but it actually lives as an experience in the cellular body down below the head. It lives in your arms, in your heart, in your stomach, and in your legs and your feet. It lives all through you. And that's a very powerful thing. You know, someone might also have that when they've been able to play an instrument and be able to do a certain piece of music that they've accomplished. Mm-hmm. And they have that in their body. And that's a very powerful. We can then recall that. We can go back to that and have that. Some people have done some ropes courses, you know, where go and you do these different things that kind of put you through your edge, and you can remember that. That's why the ropes course is so good, because it's a knowledge that enters not just the intellect, but enters the whole body. And, you know, I have an essay in there about jumping horses, and I remember I would have different trainers come in, and I remember going over this one course of fences, and it felt so good. It felt like, oh, that was such a good one. And the trainer said to me, he knew something about psychology, and he said, that was perfect. Now do it again. And I go, what? Oh, no, I can't do it again. It was an accident. It just happened. It had nothing to do with me. It was just, I could never do it again. And he knew I had that attitude. He knew that I didn't believe in myself. He knew I didn't have the confidence. And so he made me do it again, and I was able to do it a second time. And that was such a marvelous gift to me. Because so many times we do something really neat, and we say, oh, well, it wasn't really me. I didn't really have anything to do with it. So, we need to believe in ourselves that, yes, we can make a difference in our own lives.
Yeah, And that's the power of, I guess, the memory. If we can, it's those times that that's when we need to remember, when we're, you know, stuck in some other place and thinking we can't. We have to just have that, you know, those memories at our fingertips so that we can take that time and that space to remember and to feel, let our body remember.
Yes, absolutely. You know, another way of remembering is remembering the love of someone in our life, the physical touch of the love. Let's say some people are graced with having grandparents in their lives, and maybe their grandparents have moved on now, but to remember the touch of a of their parents or their grandparents or some special person in their lives, and remember that physical touch and let that be held in the heart, and go back and remember that when we start to feel afraid or feel isolated or feel unloved in some way, and remember, remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, we're on experiences with animals. Why don't we talk about your experience with the whale? Because it was such a powerful visual image and experience.
Well, you know, for about 3 years in a row, I was able to go down with a group of women friends. It was so marvelous. Down to Baja in Mexico. And it was about two-thirds of the way down on the Pacific Ocean side, in San Ignacio Lagoon. And San Ignacio is a birthing place, one of the main birthing places for the gray whale.
Mm.
And so we would just live on the beach in little tents, and it was off the grid. It, you know, we didn't have any electricity, although they had a generator, and they served great, great food. It was wonderful, this little camp. And then we would go out in these little boats, and the boats were like no more than, I don't know, 10 feet long. They were like little rowboats with a little motor on the back. And there would be, you know, like maybe 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 of us in a boat. And we would go out on this lagoon, which was pretty big, and we could only go to one part of the lagoon. We weren't allowed to run up and down the lagoon chasing whales. So we would go and we'd sit in this certain part of the lagoon, and we would sing, and we would sing. We thought that singing might help. I don't know if it helped, but it sure did feel good. And then before long, the most amazing thing, these great big mother whales. I mean, how much do they weigh? I mean, they weigh tons. I mean, they're huge. They're much longer than the boat, much bigger than the boat. Mm. I mean, they could tip us over in just a flick of a flipper or a tail or something. Mm. Not only does a mother come up, but she nudges her baby to come up and check us out. I guess I laugh. I think they must think that we're like, you know, when we're little kids, we play with bathtub toys, you know, little. We must
rubber
be their
ducky.
Bathtub toys. We're their little squeakies because we squeal and we squeak when they come up, and we just can't help ourselves. We just squeal in delight, and we touch them, and they spray their snout. We get whale snout, or you know, as they spray out their the water that they've collected inside their blowhole, and then we rub their, they have baleen, which are so these whales are true whales. They're not
domesticated, or
well, not they're not dolphins. Like
okay,
let's see, killer whales are not real whales.
They're
actually
dolphin.
From the
yeah.
dolphin family.
Mm-hmm.
And so these whales, they're baleen whales, and you rub their baleen like you rub their gums, and it's just the most amazing thing to actually. They open their mouths, and you actually rub inside. You put your hand inside their mouth. I mean, it's in their eye. They look you in the eye to eye. It is amazing. It is life changing. And even if you don't get to touch one, although I must say every time we went out there was some encounter, just to be in that close a proximity to watch them, you know, jump and breach and go in and out of the water and stand up with their tails and just kind of, we call it spy hopping, where they just kind of, I felt like that what they were doing is getting massaged by the currents, which were very strong there. The tides would come in and out, and I thought, I think they're doing a massage. And I asked the local biologist, could that be it? And they said, well, it could be. It could be that it really feels good on their body. So who knows? It just was marvelous time.
And just the mat, you know, when you talk about the size difference and, you know, it's like, it's hard to imagine. And the fact that they've been around for 60 million years, I mean, just the whole richness of the experience sounds quite incredible.
And that's why we need to make sure that we save them, that we don't destroy their culture or their oceans and fill it with so much noise. The oceans right now are full of noise pollution. And it's a real problem. So, you know, because we can't, now this is part, you know, part of the programming that we do, one of the subjects we cover is ecology. And, you know, because we can't see underneath the ocean what we're doing to it, it's as if we're not hurting it at all. But it's so marvelous that there's more and more information now coming out how important the oceans are. We'll be doing an interview with Sylvia Earle, who is a deep sea scientist, and I'm just so looking forward to being with her and talking to her. She goes down in these submarines down very, very, very deep into the ocean, and bath escapes, I think they're called, and it just she's seen some of the most amazing creatures that maybe first time ever that a human being has seen.
Wow.
So it's quite wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so one more experience with the animals, which was your experience with the flies during a...
Oh, I'm so glad you asked about that. You know, the book is about more than just animals.
Oh, yes.
But this particular... part of the book, because I just love animals so much. The flies, it was such an amazing story because I did a vision quest, and the whole story of this is there in the book, and it's really laid out much better than I can tell it. But I went on a vision quest, and the Sidonia Cahill, who was leading the quest, and my very good friend, she said, now you may encounter an animal or some animals, and so pay attention to that. And so I thought, oh, goody. So you're 3 days solo, and you have nothing with you but your notebook, your rattle, your sleeping bag, a tarp, and water. That's it for 3 days, because you're fasting for 3 days. And that's it. And, I mean, she was very, very tough. No luxuries there. And so I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll see a coyote or maybe even a rattlesnake or armadillo or, you know, who knows what. And so I imagined all sorts of eagles. And so that first morning, you know, I get up and I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden I realize that these flies are buzzing around my head. Oh, my gosh. Am I going to have to spend 3 days with this? I'm going to go insane. It was going to drive me batty. And so I resisted. I was trying to bat them away. And, of course, I do that. They would just get more and more loud and insistent and circle round and round. And so finally I just went into the place. You know, I finally said, okay, just, you know, you know how to do this. Let's go. Let's meditate. Let's just calm ourselves down. Let's do some deep breathing. Let's relax. Let's ground ourselves. And so I started to do that. And as I did that, I started to notice that the flies actually had a song, that I could actually hear different pitches. Like in different flies had different slightly different songs or different sounds, and they would buzz around my head. So it was binaural. So it'd go from one ear to the next. To the, you know, it was like a good Bose headphones or something, you know. And then I started to really listen to them. And then when I did that, I really relaxed, and it just became a wholly different experience, because no longer was it an aggravation and just this terrible thing going on that I had no control over whatsoever, but that I gave myself fully to it, and it transformed. It was just marvelous. And then I stood up to take a walk, and they were just like puppy dogs. They just loved taking a walk, and they got all excited about that. And I just said, okay, we'll go for a walk, come on. And then once I gave in to them and I just was there with them, they were with me for a little bit, and then they disappeared. Mm-hmm. And that was my lesson. And they never returned. They didn't return. They weren't with me for the whole 3 days, but they were there for that lesson. It was quite an amazing to be curious about something and to go into it, not with resistance, but with curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And it transformed, and it became a wonderful experience.
Hmm. Yeah, the great thing about your book is that, you know, there's this rich weaving of tapestry that goes on, and there's always, you know, I love reading books, and I, you know, I want to talk about absolutely everything, and you know, an hour is not enough.
I know, an hour is just not enough time. Mm-hmm. Oh,
but you know, let's try and go into the other areas. And I think that you're very passionate about being an activist, and you've sort of, you know, encourage us through your stories to, you know, to find whatever it is that, you know, we feel passionate about. And, you know, it's never going to be just one thing. And certainly, you know, in the 35 years, you've probably done quite a few. And usually what will happen is that you get excited about it and you delve into it, and then you'll do a show about it. And or you might do a circle on it, or you'll do something about it. And I think what you're encouraging us to do is, you know, not just to lead a passive life. You know, it doesn't mean that we have to, and there, in no way do you say this, but I mean, a lot of people, you know, they fight against something, and mm-hmm. you know, what we resist persists, and
right.
you know, certainly that is not the way to do it. It's about informing ourselves, and it's about, you know, making, I guess, conscious choices about what it is that would help, or what, you know, ways to educate and bring people in. And so I really like how you did that. And your stories are all, you know, these tapestries of how we, you know, we can do some of that. But so the one, let's talk about the trim tab factor.
Yes, the trim tab factor. That's such a good one. You know, the trim tab is a term that I learned from R. Buckminster Fuller. That's the first time I heard that particular term. And actually, the trim tab is that tab that it's on airplanes, but I'm not sure what it looks like on an airplane, but on a huge ship, let's say one of those big ocean liners.
Okay.
If that, there's the rudder in the back, and an ocean liner is headed in one direction, well, there is no mechanical device that is strong enough to turn that rudder against the tide of the direction it's going. It just would break the rudder. There's no way to do it. So what the inventors did and the engineers did, what they did, they put a small trim tab on the edge of that long, long rudder that runs up and down from the top of the ship down, way down below the water. And it is a... So it may not even be, but more than a couple of inches wide. I mean, it's very, very small. And what happens is that can be turned, and then that small energy of turning that starts the energy of the bigger momentum, and the bigger momentum, and pretty soon then the whole ship is able to turn. So we have to look at every time we do one small thing to make the world a better place. It's like adjusting that trim tab on a giant vessel of some, we're adding to some global change, and it's just a marvelous thing. And little things can, I tell the story of Tom Greenaway in one of those essays, and he was a colleague for many years, over 20 years, and he moved up to, when we moved up to Ukiah, when we moved from San Francisco up here, he moved up at some point, and one of the things that he would do is that when, once he moved up here, he every Wednesday night at 6 o'clock, they had a public meeting of the city council here in Ukiah, and he would go to that city council meeting. Now, he never said anything, Lori. He just sat there and witnessed, and sometimes he would be there, and there would be hundreds of people there. There would all be, you know, some issue would be up, and there would be the pros and the cons, and they would all get to speak their 2 minutes worth, and all of this hubbub would take place, and then after that was over, they'd all disappear, and Tom would still be there. And it was, he went, this went on for years, and when we had a going away party for him, some of the city council people came, and they said, you know, that because Tom was there, and because he had this non-judgmental listening and witnessing, that their decisions were better because of it. Because he was there week after week, they said that they held themselves more accountable to the public they served. Now, isn't this a very, very powerful statement? Mm-hmm. It's just, to me, just so powerful. Here is, I call that a real trim tab factor. I mean, he's sitting there witnessing, and he's not even being, you know, out there standing on the ramparts, you know, protesting or anything. He's just witnessing. He may not agree with all of their decisions, but he just sits there and lovingly witnesses. And they did a better job because of it. And that just reminds me of one other thing that I'd love to make a point about. And that's that you don't have to be assured of a particular outcome in order to participate. In fact, it's best to just kind of not worry about the outcome. Vaclav Havel said, hope is a state of mind, not of the world, and it's the ability to work for something because it is good, not just because it stands a chance to succeed. And I think that's so, the Dalai Lama says the same thing. He says, I do this because it's a right and good thing for me to do. I really don't know the outcome. And so I think that that's important for us to release our attachment to a certain outcome. We may have a preference, but, you know, the truth of it might even be even more marvelous than we could ever imagine. Or it, maybe we're working for something and we're going to do more harm than good, and we don't even know it. So to really do what we can as best we can, and release the outcome, the sense of it having to be a certain way, and it just makes your life a lot better. So work for what you're passionate about. And remember always to take care of yourself, because you don't want to be out there in the world and then burn out. So it's an in-breath, out-breath is what I call it. That the in-breath is to take care of yourself, do your spiritual practice, whatever that is for you, or your introspection, be in nature, and then take it out in the world. So it's both and.
Which is a lovely way of looking at it. And you sort of talk about that with the serving life and the savoring life, which you breathe in, and as you breathe out, you're serving, you're giving value, you're offering love, which is, you know, really beautiful way of looking at that.
Yes, exactly. Yes, serving life to really remember that, and to remember to keep a gratitude journal, you know, to write some thank you letters, to to start each day thinking, before your feet even hit the floor, think of three things you're grateful for. And then at night, do the same thing. And that just starts this whole day in a kind of spacious way. Mm-hmm. So I also have an essay about the Wouldn't It Be Wonderful game when you wake up in the middle of the night, and mm-hmm. I call it the time of the wolf. You're just going, oh my goodness, there's nothing you can do. You just some sort of fear or worry just takes hold of you, and you can't go back to sleep, and you're just going, oh, and there's nothing you can do. You can't get to your computer, or you can't call that person, or whatever it is. You're just, it's kind of 4 o'clock in the morning, and you're just sort of stuck with it. And that's when I say, let's play the Wouldn't It Be Wonderful game. And so then you switch your channel. You almost like you take your remote control, and you're switching your channel to the Wouldn't It Be Wonderful channel, and you just think of something in your life that, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if, and just start to think about that. Whatever it is, whether it's remodeling your house, or whether it's world peace, you know, I mean, whatever it is, just start to focus on that and just allow yourself to sink into that, and pretty soon your whole body starts to relax again. You start deep breathing, and then pretty soon you go back to sleep, and you have great dreams.
Much better than before, yes. Now, the other area that you go into, and I guess it's kind of, you know, you give your wisdom that you've learned through the stories, and you talk about the teachers that through nature and animals, and then you share this idea of, you know, your own, from own personal experience of about creating circles. And I guess it's a way to, you know, to connect, because I think that's incredibly important, especially in this age of computers and how we can, you know, spend all day on a computer and not really have the physical connection with other people. And so you talk about the circles and the power of creating these circles and, you know, how to set them up. And obviously from, you know, your passion about them, and that they were very powerful ways to, you know, create these connections and to allow our wisdom to grow.
You know, I'm a real advocate of circles. I they have meant so much to me in my life. In this circles, when I talk about circles, I'm talking about sitting down with friends of the heart, friends who support us and who are committed to supporting us in our fullness. So it's these are people, as the African saying, who love to love someone is to learn the song that is in that person's mm-hmm. heart and to sing it to them when they have forgotten. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm talking about here. And I'm talking about an actual physical circle, mm-hmm. because there's something about just the setup, just the mandala of it, the actual geometric shape, and putting something in the very center of that circle, whether it's flowers and a candle or some sort of altar space, whatever you want to put, and where everybody can see everybody. Everybody is equal. There's no, like, teacher standing above, or we're not all in straight lines looking one way, but we're all looking at each other, and we're all feeling, all of our hearts are moving towards the center of that circle. And it's a wonderful, wonderful technology is what I would call it. And mm-hmm. and it doesn't cost anything. It's people sitting down together and committing to being with one another, to witness one another in non-judgmental ways. And as I think in the book, I talk about, like, one of my circles has been meeting for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's the same people, and our children have grown up in that circle. So they keep coming back to that circle, and yeah. so and now we live far apart, so we don't get together as often. But we, when we do come together, we now come together for 2 or 3 days at a time.
Mm.
So we used to come, you know, like one evening a week. Mm. You know, so the ways of meeting change. But we've celebrated, you know, marriages and divorces and deaths and births, and I mean the full gamut we've celebrated together. And if I may, just to share further in that African saying, and just to remind us that in my experience, humans are more intelligent when we're in the company of others who are listening to us in a deep way. There's like an alchemical change that happens when we have truly been heard and witnessed by others, and having this community. This is not a time, Lori, of for us to isolate ourselves. This is a time to come together, and it's good for developing our genius because we're more intelligent together. And the African saying goes like this. It says, I already mentioned about a friend is someone who knows your song and sings it to you when you've forgotten it. And it goes on and it says, those who love you are not fooled by mistakes you have made or dark images you hold about yourself. You know, how often we think, you know, we think, oh, other people are better than we are. And then we start to think, oh, we're, you know, we start coming down on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why we do that. We so easily fall into that. So circles help us. They help us to remember, and the saying goes like this. They remember your beauty when you feel ugly, your wholeness when you are broken, your innocence when you feel guilty, and your purpose when you are confused. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
You know, your beauty when you feel ugly, your wholeness when you are broken, your innocence when you feel guilty, and your purpose when you are confused.
Hmm.
I just love that. And that's what that is how I experience circles. And then there are all sorts of ways. I know I just read the other day, people are getting together of how to do circles to help each other simplify their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's a wonderful subject for a circle, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, as things are getting downsized. And
mm-hmm.
So how can we simplify our lives, and how can we help one another to do that? Or another circle might be communities coming together in communal ways, and that powerful, powerful way of doing it in a circle. And it doesn't mean that somebody might not help to lead a particular circle, but for me, I think it's important that no one person leads it every time.
Right.
Then it becomes a guru trip, you know, or a teacher trip. And that's not the point of circle. It's everyone in the circle has wisdom to impart, and we all do it in different ways. You know, some people are, and that's why it's good to share to maybe a talking stick, because some people are more quick to their extroverts, and they just talk. Maybe I'm one. And then other people are a little more quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to have moments in a circle that are silence, or that we pass the stick around so everyone has an opportunity to speak or to dance. Maybe someone in the circle, they don't want to use words, and they want to dance, or they want to sing, or share a poem or whatever. So everybody has their own way of it. Not everybody can share in the same exact way, and that's the diversity of the circle is so powerful, and it's what really makes for a very healthy, not only circle, but healthy society.
Mm-hmm. There's a very powerful example you give in one of your stories about the one in the women's wisdom, and how a group of women, both pro-life and pro-choice, have been meeting for 5 years.
Oh, yes. That was so powerful. What happened, these women, there was some years ago, there was some people that were shot at a abortion clinic in Boston, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so some pro-life women and I don't remember the names, but those who were for abortion or pro-life or pro-choice.
Choice.
I can't remember the euphemisms for it, you know, because those words are so carefully honed. But
yeah, pro-choice.
Pro-choice, thank you. And so they got together in secret for 5 years, and they talked to one another for secret for 5 years. That was just amazing to me. And so then they all appeared on this panel at Women in Power at Omega Institute is where I saw it. And what happened, you know, you were hoping that they would come together in their thinking, that they would come to some sort of compromise or something. But they never did. They never moved from their position. However, they fell in love with one another.
Mm-hmm.
They came to each other's events. They really became just such great friends. And one of the things that I noticed, that I learned about the difference between progressives, people who are working in a more progressive way, and people who are working in a more dogmatic way. And at the very end, when they said that they wanted to put this out in a publication, and they said, but we need to state our purpose and what we stand for at the beginning of the publication. So that the women who were coming from the one idea of pro-life and against abortion, They had their statement written out in a less than 24 hours, and they turned it in. The other women, it took them like 3 months to come up with their statement. And that was just, for me, a demonstration of true democracy, when you're just having to talk about some issue from so many viewpoints.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just one viewpoint, but it's very nuanced, and it's very deep, and it's messy, and it's not clear cut. It would just be so great if we could just say, okay, this is the way it is, and we don't have to worry about it anymore. And I really got that from these women, that you know, democracy is kind of a messy thing. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of deep listening. It takes a lot of holding each other and expanding our own viewpoint and getting off of our own particular soapboxes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy thing, and that's what we're being required to do now.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And it just was a really, I think, you know, a very powerful statement about how, you know, and, you know, it's not just women, but, you know, that they could, you know, that they could find, you know, their nurturing, helpful, like they still connected, even though in their differences.
Oh, they did, even though they were diametrically opposed on the issue. There was such a deep respect. Through that dialogue, they became faces to one another.
Mm-hmm.
They became real to one another. And even though they didn't change their opinion in the particular issue, but they came to such a deep, deep sense of tolerance and lovingness. And that's the whole point. It's not about changing each other's mind, but it's about not going to war over it.
Exactly.
And that was the whole point of it, because I felt so badly that there were some extremists that would go to such an extreme that people died because of it. And they were saying, these women were saying, that had such good hearts, no matter what side of the issue they were on, that they said, no more will we have any more of this. We will not go to that kind of terroristic activity. And we must sit down and talk. We must be with each other. We must learn to disagree and to be civil in our disagreement.
Kind of gives you hope when you think of, you know, the wars that we get caught up in because of our differences.
And,
you know, if we could do that with everybody and, you know, come together instead of, you know, fighting the differences, it does give you hope.
Definitely. Definitely. It does absolutely give you hope. Absolutely.
So the last part is about, you know, learning to find those small pleasures and to celebrate and to play and to, you know, to really enjoy ourselves.
Exactly. You know, we forget to celebrate. We forget to celebrate. And in one of the essays, I quote Bill McDonough, who is an anticipatory design architect. And he says, I just love how he puts it. He says, you know, it's not about survival of the fittest. It's about those who celebrate the most being the true evolutionary winners. Nature is all about fierce celebration. And, you know, we see it when we look all around us. But why so many different species of flowers and insects and just trees and, you know, animals and just all the variety. It's all about fierce celebration and to remember the big celebrations, but remember our daily celebration. Celebrate all, you know, just remember to celebrate. Celebrate all the little things. Celebrate that that you got to scratch something off of your to-do list. That's a celebration.
Yes.
Definitely. So, you know, to remember that, you know, I can think of Paul Newman. I heard that a few days before he died, he was sitting in the garden under the arbor with one of his daughters, and she said he was taking in the fall air and the sunshine, and he let out a sigh, and he said very softly, "It's been a privilege to be here." Isn't that beautiful? What a marvelous sense of celebration as his life is ebbing out, and he was just celebrating that day with his daughter out in the arbor and just celebrating life. I love that, and I just would love to just leave your listeners to with a blessing that may each of you find joy in what you love, in the company of those you love, and have the courage to go on doing it and just never, never, ever lose that joy.
One last thing.
Yes.
You write at the very beginning, so what's it all about?
What's it all about?
Mm-hmm.
I do. What is it all about? Did I write?
I believe it's love.
Yes. Oh, yes, it's all about love. It is. Isn't that the magic ingredient? What's it all about? And yes, thank you for reminding us all. It's all about love.
Yes, it awakens our connection.
Pardon me?
It awakens our connection.
It does. It does. It awakens our connection with one another. It awakens our hearts. That particular essay was about. I heard this story. A man shared about this wonderful professor that was so popular in I think it was the University of Wisconsin, and everybody would go to his lectures, and they just sat on pins and needles. And at the very end of the semester, he would say, "Well, you know, I'm going to tell you that nothing that I've said this whole semester really, really matters." And but I'm going to tell you what the whole secret really is. I'm going to reveal it to you right now. And he would do this long pause, and everybody was sitting on the edge of their seats, and he would say, "Love, that's what it's all about." And with that, he would turn around and leave the room.
Nice.
And it was, I just feel that that's really true. That's what it is all about. And it's that glue that pulls it all together. I think it's what makes the universe be what it is. It's all about love, that attraction, that way that we are glue for each other.
Well, yeah. Justine Toms, it has been a great pleasure to talk about small pleasures and to invite you to Intuitive Soul Radio. Why don't you tell people how they can get a hold of you, how they, you know...
Oh, I would love to. Thank you. You know, the main website is newdimensions.org, and you can get to my book from there, or you can get to over 800 hours of digital downloads from that website, and you can sign up to get our podcast, or you can sign up to get our weekly spotlight. So do visit the website, and you'll find all sorts of goodies there.
Mm-hmm.
And may you all enjoy many small pleasures.
Well, thank you very much, and it's been a great pleasure.
Lori, it's been my pleasure. It's just been wonderful being on with you. You've been a wonderful host. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. So take care. We'll
Thank
see you next week. Okay.